From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We talk with the Michigan Chamber about Michigan corporations getting more tax refunds than they pay.
That tax policy, that approach to economic development was very costly. Many people think it is a failure, but the bill is due.
A Detroit public school student speaks out.
We have a shortage in books, in teachers, in just materials that we need.
Then a talk with one of Founders Brewing founders.
As long as we're still having fun, we're going to keep doing it. And I just can't imagine not having fun in the beer industry.
A new kind of fertilizer from sewage sludge.
These materials are being applied all over Ohio, Canada, as well as Michigan.
Plus, a cocktail recipe for free right here at Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up on today's show, the Detroit area's sewage is being turned into crop fertilizer. Billed as one of the largest operations of its kind in North America, the practice sure has caught the attention of some noses in rural Lenawee County. Later on, we'll learn more about the process and find out if it's safe and can be made less, well, stinky. But first, the Detroit News reported yesterday that Michigan corporations will receive tax refunds that exceed corporate tax payments to the state. In other words, there will be a net loss. Corporations will get back more than they pay. Two things are happening here. First, tax credits have increased as chiefly auto companies are cashing in on those incentives. And second, tax revenues are down. To help us better understand how we got to this point is Rich Studley. He's the CEO of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. When and why did we start offering these tax credits that are costing the state so much in refunds now?
It is important to remember that Governor Snyder proposed the corporate income tax to replace the old Michigan business tax. For many years, under previous administrations, the Michigan business tax was very complicated, very burdensome. It was essentially a European-style value-added tax. It was hated by Michigan's job providers, and in fact, the tax was so complicated and so controversial for many years, out-of-state companies looking to build new facilities simply didn't consider Michigan because the tax was so burdensome and so difficult to understand they couldn't run a comparison with the corporate income tax, which is common in most other states.
Okay, so that's the background. What happened when these tax credits were proposed? When were they proposed and why were they proposed?
During the Granholm administration, Governor Granholm believed in industrial policy. She was comfortable with government picking winners and losers. And the previous administration granted very large company-specific tax breaks to certain companies and businesses. That tax policy, that approach to economic development was very costly. Many people think it is a failure, but the bill is due.
It was a recession at the time, though. Michigan was desperate to keep auto manufacturing plants here rather than lose them to states such as Texas. How successful have those credits been in keeping jobs here?
Well, you know, it's ironic that we refer to the lost decade as the Great Recession. It wasn't great. It was awful. We were bleeding jobs, and I think some of those credits were helpful in retaining current businesses, but other credits, like the Hollywood film subsidy, for example, were complete failures. And so state is obliged to honor those contracts or commitments as we go forward together. But one of the big concerns we have about this article is it creates the false impression that the corporate income tax is the only tax that business pays, and that's simply not true. Every year, Michigan businesses pay hundreds of millions of dollars in unemployment insurance taxes, billions of dollars in property taxes, hundreds of millions of dollars in sales and use taxes, hundreds of millions of dollars in motor fuel taxes. The oil and gas industry pays a severance tax in lieu of business taxes. And so I think you have to look at the entire context. Employees and employers, businesses pay billions of dollars every year to state government beyond simply the revenue included in the corporate income tax.
Understood. We're looking at jobs now. The governor released a statement this week saying we've seen the number of jobs increase by 462,000 since December of 2010. That lost decade, as you mentioned, the state lost 806,000 jobs. Critics say the jobs that have returned, mostly due to the national recovery, and add that overall those jobs are lower paying than in the past. So what's the outlook for full recovery under the tax system we have now?
At the Michigan Chamber, we're optimistic about our state's future. There are national and international events that impact on our state. We're a manufacturing state. We're still the 10th largest state in the country. But changes in state policy have also been very important. Repeal of the old MBT, which was a jobs killer, replacing it with a corporate income tax, more simple, more fair, more like other states. The decision at the state level to become a right-to-work state. There have been a lot of positive changes in public policy at the state level that have contributed to our economic turnaround.
There are now negotiated caps for the amount of credits cashed in, but how much longer will the state of Michigan have to keep paying out these refunds?
It's unclear because many of these agreements have not been made public. My impression is that responsible Michigan employers have stepped up and renegotiated the tax incentives that they have received. They should be commended for that. But my impression is that this is a multi-year challenge. Michigan is working again. Employment is up. And even in the short term, when you look at the decline in the corporate income tax, the Treasury Department has indicated that a lot of that is the result of increased hiring, which in the short run increases business expenses and reduces profits, but in the long run results in more economic activity.
So is that why we've seen a reduction in revenues from the business sector this year?
That is part of it, yes.
What are we going to see in the next few years as far as the state's budget is concerned?
Well, again, it's important to add context to this article. The proposed budget for October 1st will still be somewhere between $54 and $55 billion. That is an all-time historic high for our state. It is important for your listeners to understand that overall state spending has gone up about $1 billion a year every year for the last 6 years. So overall revenue is still up. Overall spending is still up. Only in Washington, D.C. and in Lansing is a decrease in the rate of increase in taxes and spending called a cut.
Rich Studley is the CEO of Michigan Chamber of Commerce. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lester. Glad to be helpful.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Sunday marks the birthday of Dr. Arthur Conan Doyle. Now, while he's known as an author and the creator of Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Doyle was something of a sleuth in his own profession. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS NewsHour contributor Dr. Howard Markell joins me now. Before we get to know the author's story, we have to know about another doctor, Robert Koch. So who is he?
Well, Robert Koch was perhaps the greatest medical detective of all. He discovered the germ that causes tuberculosis, the germ that causes anthrax and cholera, and he developed a set of rules that other bacteriologists had to follow to prove that agent X actually causes disease Y.
So Koch was announcing a big discovery at a medical conference in Berlin. What was it?
Well, these were the days when all doctors went to the same conference. Now medicine is so splintered. There's cardiologists and pediatricians and what have you. But this was the World Congress of Medicine. It was filled with an all-star cast of doctors, but the biggest star was Robert Koch. And in 1890, in a blistering heated day in August, he announced he had, quote, a remedy for tuberculosis.
This was a big deal, right?
It was a huge deal because it was the leading cause of death of people between 20 and 45 years of age. And it was on everybody's mind. So this made front page news around the world almost instantly.
So Arthur Conan Doyle, who's got his little practice in England, he decides, hey, I'm going to Berlin. I want to hear this announcement from Koch himself. But he didn't have tickets to the event. It's a huge event. What happened?
Well, he was practicing and he was writing his first Sherlock Holmes story, but he just was stunned by this announcement. He went to London very quickly and got an assignment so he could write about it for the Review of Reviews. And when he got to Berlin, as you're right, he did not have a golden ticket to get in. So he tried all sorts of things, even stalking Koch and going to his home. And finally, a doctor named Hertz from Detroit, Michigan, got him in to see the great exhibition.
So it turns out that Doyle was a little skeptical. He did some investigation, some deductive reasoning, just like Sherlock Holmes, to Dr. Koch's discovery, what did he find?
Well, this is the really remarkable part. He noted that it really didn't cure tuberculosis. It may have done something to an early patient.
So not a remedy.
Not a remedy at all. He found it's probably a good way of diagnosing TB. In fact, what Koch's tuberculin cure was a TB test. It was an old-fashioned TB test because it actually used tuberculosis microbes. We now use something called purified protein derivative, which is a little bit safer. But that's what Conan Doyle said months ahead of the time that Robert Koch finally admitted, you know, it's not a remedy. I made a mistake, but it is a good diagnostic tool.
It's a pretty bold thing for a small-town doctor challenging the findings of an internationally known medical researcher. How was it received?
Well, you're right. It took a lot of chutzpah, as my grandfather might say, to do that. But it was received rather well in that the Review of Reviews was a major magazine at the time, and Robert Koch must have been aware of it. Also, he was finding more data that it simply wasn't working. Conan Doyle later said in his own autobiography that event changed his life.
Why is that?
Because he really learned to trust his own instincts and his own brilliant mind. And in fact, the man behind Sherlock Holmes was a pretty good diagnostician himself.
Looks like it. Dr. Howard Markel is University of Michigan's medical historian and a PBS NewsHour contributor. Thanks for the story.
Elementary.
Next time you're driving by Mackinac City, right at the base of the Big Mac Bridge, you will behold what could be the world's biggest hot dog. A former Disney artist from Florida responded to the request from a hot dog shop called Wienerlicious. He's molded spray polyurethane foam into a 63-foot-long hot dog. By the way, he's the same artist who created the 30-foot-tall grizzly bear, also seen in Mackinac City. The Wienerlicious team is waiting for confirmation from the Guinness World Record team as to whether Michigan can lay claim to the world's biggest hot dog. We always want to hear from you. What stories are you focused on? What issues do you want to hear more about right here on Stateside? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio, and of course at michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. Up next, a 16-year-old student offers her take on what's happening with Detroit public schools. And then how Founders Brewing Company is working to quench the world's thirst for craft beer. Stay with us. This is Stateside for Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The future of the Detroit Public Schools as a functioning district is in some doubt. The legislature is haggling over the Senate plan to give $700 million to pay off debt and keep the district running, or the smaller House bill, which is $500 million and includes things such as allowing uncertified teachers. That has a lot of people, some legislators, the governor, some business leaders, and teachers very concerned. And then there are the students. One sophomore at Detroit's Renaissance High sat down, wrote how she felt about what's happening to the Detroit public schools, and that letter was picked up and published in a number of publications. Imani Harris joins us now. Imani, would you please read a couple paragraphs from your letter?
Of course. My name is Imani Harris, and I'm a very concerned sophomore at Renaissance High School. I'm writing this letter because I am appalled. I am appalled at the fact that there was ever a thought that already struggling teachers should work for free while our emergency manager, legislators, etc. continue to be paid. I am appalled that teachers had to resort to striking because they were not taken seriously with just their words. I am appalled that teachers were then shamed for standing out. It is not their First Amendment right to protest peacefully. I am appalled that adults that have never been to nor had children in a DPS school would dare tell teachers that they are wrong while they sit at home and receive their paycheck. I am appalled that it took 2 days of me being at home for there to be some solution.
So you are appalled at a lot. What was the final straw that broke the camel's back that prompted you to write this letter?
The final straw, there were actually two. So one of the final straws was I was at home and I woke up for school the next day, and my mom was like, well, yeah, I stayed up all night watching this, and the House actually passed, you know, the House bill. And I was just like, really? Because I didn't expect for it to happen. I was like, oh, this is a joke. It's not serious. And then the second straw was me actually reading some things that were in the bill, some things about uncertified teachers and getting rid of the unions and them having to reapply for their jobs every year and just having the possibility of them maybe just being fired just because.
Right. The House bill is about $200 million smaller than the Senate bill. Do you think these proposals will be suggested for other districts?
That was another thing that I wrote in my letter that I feel like, I know that people say the race card is pulled all of the time, and that's because the race card is plucked all of the time. So I do believe that it has something to do with the fact that we are a poor black neighborhood. So I don't think that this will happen in another neighborhood, hiring an uncertified teacher to come teach me something that they haven't even went to school to teach.
What do you think is motivating the legislators?
Well, my theory is that everything in Detroit and everything in the world revolves around money and power. And so I know that people who did vote for this may not even know what's in the House bills and may not even know what's going on, but because, you know, they get money from here, get money from there, telling them, hey, vote yes on this bill, they'll vote for it. And as far as the people who wrote it, I have not an inkling of an idea of what made, I mean, I feel like that part wasn't even necessary. Like, the uncertified teachers part, like, the bill could have went fine without that, so I don't even understand what made them include that in there.
Tell me a little bit about your school. In fact, tell me about your grade school and Renaissance High.
So I went to a private school called Cornerstone. I went to the one in Nevada, and I was there from pre-K all the way to eighth grade. And for high school, I decided to go to a public school because I had wanted to go to Renaissance since I was little. So I now go to Renaissance. I'm in the 10th grade, and I love my school. It pushes me. It's not easy at all, and it feels like I'm in college. But I know that when I get to college, I'll be completely prepared. I love my school. I love the teachers that I do have. I love the people in the school. Yeah.
There's been a lot of concern about some of the conditions of the school buildings. Is Renaissance
right.
High one of those buildings, or is your school in good shape?
As far as the building goes, we're in pretty good shape. We are more on the material side. So, like, we don't have a lot of books. We don't have a lot of teachers. They've had to change classes. My brother had a Spanish class, and his Spanish teacher quit, so now he takes a humanities class. And then there was a French class, and their teacher also left, and so now they take an elective called Great Books. We have a shortage of teachers, and when we do get teachers, for instance, when I didn't have an English teacher, I went through 5 English teachers in the span of 3 months just because they were just filling in so that I could have some type of English learning because it's not a separate language, so English is important. They're trying to fill that need. So our building isn't in, you know, we don't have mold on the walls, and I mean, we don't have that. But we have a shortage in books and teachers and just materials that we need.
You understand that not being able to hold on to certified teachers like you were just talking about might be one of the reasons that the legislature is saying, let's make it more available to people who are trained but not necessarily certified. I mean, does that make sense to you?
I mean, it makes sense to a certain extent, but I feel like if nobody wants to stay in DPS, there's a reason. So instead of saying, well, hey, since nobody wants to say, let's hire uncertified teachers, maybe they should take a step back and look at themselves and say, hey, maybe we're doing something that's making us not be able to keep teachers. So I understand that they might feel like hiring an uncertified teacher fixes the problem, but if they have a problem with test scores, and they have a problem with our percentage of college graduates and even people getting into college is low, I don't think that hiring an uncertified teacher is going to fill that gap.
What kind of response have you gotten from your letter? It's been published in a lot of places.
I've gotten some negative, some positive. From people that I know, of course, I've gotten positive. A lot of people where it was shared have commented good things, you know, oh, DPS does have good students coming out of it. But then I've also gotten a lot of negative comments. Somebody even said that they feel like this letter wasn't written by me, that they feel like the government wrote this letter and put my name on it. And that was funny to me. But I've also gotten things like, you know, you're pulling a race card and this letter, you don't even understand the issues and nobody wants to give any money to people in Detroit and we're tired of funding Detroit. Nobody wants to pay taxes for it. So.
Well, I think that as a 16-year-old author of this letter, it shows a lot of curiosity and a lot of insight. And so I'm going to give you a compliment on this letter just because you're asking the right questions and expressing mm-hmm. the feelings of many students at Detroit Public Schools, mm-hmm. I'm assuming.
Thank you so much.
That is Imani Harris. She's a sophomore at Detroit's Renaissance High School. She wrote about how she feels about what's happening to Detroit public schools. It was published in the Free Press and Metro Times. Thanks very much, Imani.
No problem. Thank you. Nice meeting you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A lot of us love our wide variety of Michigan beers and ales. I don't think it's too strong to state we feel a sort of ownership of our favorite brews. That's why eyebrows were raised a little bit more than a year ago when we heard Founders Brewing Company was selling 30% of its business to a foreign investor. The partnership with the Spanish brewer Mao San Miguel opens up a huge new market for the Michigan company. With us to talk about that move is one of the founders of Founders, Mike Stevens. Before we start talking about the partnership, what kind of response did you get to partnering with the Spanish brewer? Because social media was all abuzz about it at the time, and not all of it was terribly positive.
Yeah, we were highly sensitive to, the way our consumers would look at it. We had, an army of PR folks the day of our release stationed here just to monitor social media. And Lester, I got to tell you, honestly, of the negative response, they kind of pie chart the day. I mean, at the end of the day, we only had 4% negative response to our release of the news. So overall, it was very, very positive. There was obviously a lot of just neutral responses on the social media, but I think all in all, we did a great job messaging the platform, and it's an authentic platform. So I think once you hear the story of why, it makes sense.
Well, a lot of people were saying, let's wait and see. So I'm wondering what's happened now. What kind of stepping stone is this partnership and worldwide distribution of Founders Beers and Ales?
Well, prior to our partnership with Mao San Miguel, we were probably distributing into maybe 10 countries. We are now in 22 countries. They have global distribution. They don't distribute here in the United States. They've had a high respect to the way we go to market in the U.S. If anything, they want to learn from us how American craft beer plays domestically. But where they offer some help to us is on a global distribution outlook. And these are folks that have been doing this for 125 years. Same family still owns the brewery. And, they're the ones that we get together with quarterly at the board meetings. They're wonderful, wonderful people. And they care about legacy of brands. When we went down the path of looking at succession planning, the number one thing that was important to us was legacy of our brands. It was important that Dave and I and the ownership saw a way that, someday when we're gone and no longer selling beer, the brand can still survive and give opportunity for our kids to be a part of the brewery and create the next generations, just as the folks at Mao have.
So has most of this distribution been in the EU?
Yeah, most of it is. Our real hot spots would be England, Scandinavia, Australia, believe it or not, sells quite a bit. We've entered a little bit into the Asian markets, and that looks promising. And we are just about to open Mexico, which also I think should be pretty promising for us.
So what's been the impact of all this expansion as far as at the brewery in Grand Rapids?
Our team is used to 50% plus growth rates for last 8 years. Honestly, our compounded annual growth rate has been around 60%. It's dynamic here, but it's also all we know. Life will slow down, I think, for us someday, and I would say that's within maybe 3 to 5 years, but we've still got a lot of growth to do. We're completing an expansion here at the corporate headquarters on the southwest corner. Be wrapping that up in about 6 months, and then we purchased a building, 200,000 square foot building just off of 131 here in downtown Grand Rapids that will be taking care of all of our warehousing needs, as well as a new brewery that will focus solely on our specialty products and barrel aging products. That will be completed around August.
Sounds like you just have terrible problems.
Yeah, we're fortunate the world likes beer, and they obviously like good beer now. So it's a change. It's a shift in palates. And
I want to talk about that just a little bit. When I travel increasingly around the U.S., I see or I can expect to find Founders Ales, even in an area such around St. Louis, Missouri, which has some decent craft brewers and a little company called Anheuser-Busch. Just
right.
How far and wide are you distributed in the U.S.?
Yeah, we're in call it 40 states, and we are in 22 countries. Founders right now is the 13th largest craft brewer in the country. With our growth rate and with the success of one key brand, All Day IPA, the trajectory of that has us somewhere around probably 700,000 barrels to a million barrels by 2020.
Yeah, I think for people who aren't familiar with that, it is an IPA, as it says in its name, but it's a session IPA, which means it's lower in alcohol, which is attractive these days.
That's exactly it. I mean, we cut our teeth making really what they call high gravity, which is basically, you know, it's a high alcohol beer because you could get very creative. The higher the alcohol, you know, it allows for some creativity. But through the decades, we started to just see some trends where this craft beer movement, very strong, very alive. The individuals want full flavor, but got to the point where we were sick of, you know, 8, 9, 10% beers. So we developed this session ale, we call it, and we were kind of the first to market with it. So we're finding that right now All Day IPA is the number one selling session ale in America by volume. And our can pack in particular is the number two best selling craft can pack in America. So it's really done a lot for us in terms of our growth and our trajectory and kind of getting us on that national platform. We are definitely considered one of the national players in the craft scene now.
We've seen a lot of craft brewers pop up in Michigan as well as across the entire country. Some of them are putting out some great product. How close is the craft brewing industry to market saturation or oversaturation?
Well, I think there was probably around 400 breweries when we started 20 years ago, and there's about, I think, 4,300 now. So it's definitely grown. I mean, we have more breweries now in the United States than we did in the history, you know, prior to Prohibition when there was a brewery on every corner. We've exceeded that number now. But, you know, I'm not fearful that we've reached saturation at all. I actually still feel that the current market share that we have in the U.S. with American craft beer could double in the next 10 years. And I honestly don't think that's far-fetched. And I think a lot of industry analysts you would find are saying the same thing.
I was going to say there are a lot of Bud Light, Miller Light drinkers out there who just can't see paying $12 for a six-pack of ale or beer, or just don't appreciate the products from the craft beer producers. How far can the craft brewing industry go before it runs out of converts?
Well, here's the situation. Here's where I think you just have a fundamental switch or change, a paradigm shift, I guess, in the beer palate world. But, you know, when we opened our brewery, we had a lot of parents coming in, you know, had little kids, and now we're serving those little kids. There's a whole new generation that we've watched grow up watching mom and dad drink nothing but craft beer out of their fridge or at their favorite restaurants. These kids, you know, they're our customers who we talk to and who we engage with. They know nothing other than craft beer. The concept of grabbing a Bud, a Miller, a Coors does not even exist in their mind. So you've got a whole nother generation coming that's going to just snowball this craft beer movement even greater. This is where I see that this market share can continue to grow. I think there's always a place for Bud, Miller, and Coors, but quite frankly, a lot of that opportunity now is overseas.
What's next for founders?
Keep doing what we do. You know, I mean, that's what's next really is probably a focus more on our specialty products. You know, it's the world that we love as home brewers, and that's why we're building the new facility so that we can kind of get back to some of those roots. You know, All Day has kind of consumed the capacity here in the main campus. So I think it's just more creativity and more just living life and having fun. I mean, we're a company built on no regrets, and it's kind of our motto around here. And as long as we're still having fun, we're going to keep doing it. And I just can't imagine not having fun in the beer industry.
That's Mike Stevens, who, along with Dave Engber, has started the Founders Brewing Company in 1997 in Grand Rapids. Thanks very much for talking with us.
You got it, Lester. Thank you.
It's the weekend, just about time for a drink. Here with Tammy's Tastings is Tammy Coxon.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. A lot of the state's fancy pants and bigwigs will soon be heading up to the Mackinac Island Policy Conference. And you and I were talking about what kind of cocktail recipe you might have that could relate to that conference.
Well, I know if I was hanging out with policy wonks all day, I'd want a drink. So this drink is a Michigan riff off of a cocktail from a bar in New York City called Death & Company. It's their cocktail's called The Conference, and we're calling it the Michigan Conference.
So what's in your Michigan Conference?
So this is an unusual drink because it uses a variety of different spirits instead of just one base spirit. So we have half an ounce of rye from Journeyman Distillery. We have half an ounce of bourbon that we got from Two James Distillery in Detroit. And then we have half an ounce of an apple brandy. Nobody in Michigan's making that yet, but they will soon. And half an ounce of a brandy or a cognac. To go with that and give it a little bit of a Michigan touch, we're adding some maple syrup. The original recipe called for a different kind of sugar syrup, so we're sweetening it with a Michigan touch here. And then to bring us to Mackinac, I always think of Mackinac Island fudge, so we're going to use some chocolate bitters as well as some Angostura bitters. That'll get stirred up with ice. And then we're going to garnish that with a lemon twist and an orange twist.
Lots of Michigan ingredients. Did the Michigan conference taste that much different from the original conference?
It is definitely a little bit different, but this is an old-fashioned style drink. You know, it's a boozy sipper. You serve it over ice, and you just kind of relax with it. And so the feel of the drinks is very similar, and then it just has a little bit more Michigan flavor.
My prediction is next summer we're going to see this in some of the Mackinac Island bars.
That'd be awesome.
All right, thanks very much.
Thanks. Cheers.
Still to come, Detroit area sewage is making its way onto Michigan farms in the form of fertilizer pellets. The practice has not gone unnoticed in rural Lenawee County.
This was like nothing we'd ever smelled before, to the point where it would take your breath away and almost hurt your throat.
Is the practice safe, and can it be done without offending people's noses? We'll learn more about that after the break. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Well, it's springtime in Michigan, and for farmers, that means plowing the soil, planting crops, spreading fertilizer. This year, however, things have been a little bit more, odoriferous.
This was like nothing we'd ever smelled before, to the point where it would take your breath away and almost hurt your throat.
It ruined my birthday. People had to hold their breaths. They didn't even want to breathe.
It was almost like a manure smell, but almost kind of a chemical type smell with it as well.
That's James Bryja and his daughter Nevia of Lenawee County describing the scent of a new fertilizer created from the sewer sludge from the Great Lakes Water Authority facility in Detroit. You might remember them as the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department. That's where the waste from roughly 4 million people in southeast Michigan is processed. A company called the New England Fertilizer Company, NEFCO, then takes the sludge to create a solid fertilizer to be used by farmers. Emmanuel Arujo is the vice president of operations at NEFCO, the company which is using sewage sludge from the Detroit Water and Sewage Department and turns it into fertilizer pellets. So how does this process work?
Yeah, it's basically a thermal drying process. We take wastewater solids, which are suspended in water, and we dewater it, form what's called a cake in the business. And that cake is then fed to a drying system where air is heated to about 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit in order to dry the product to basically 97% dry and kill all the pathogens. That air is then treated before it's discharged, and the end product is a granulated fertilizer-grade biosolids pellet.
You mentioned how hot it gets to kill off the pathogens, but the sewage is not just household flushing, but it includes effluent from industry. What's being done to ensure things like heavy metals or other toxic materials are not being spread on farm fields and possibly getting into crops or animals that graze the pastures?
Both the EPA and the state of Michigan have very tight laws and limits for any kind of contaminants in the biosolids. So the material is tested routinely, and, you know, those laws are and limits are designed to make sure that public safety is met.
We've been getting some complaints from around the state about the smell from the use of these pellets that are spread on farm fields. Why is that happening?
There is a certain smell, especially if the material is, when it's re-wetted, that whether it's offensive or not is individual taste, if you will. I use the material myself, and the odor does go away after a little while. What's happened is really just a process of decomposition. The material is organic matter, and that organic matter is being returned to the soil through a decomposition process.
So this isn't a mistake. This is the way the product operates.
Absolutely.
What do you want to say to the people who have complained about this?
Well, I've actually spoken with many of the people who have complained about it personally, and what I would say is it's one of the best beneficial reuses of biosolids material that there is. There's other options that are out there, as incineration, and that has air pollution impacts. Some of the material is landfilled throughout the United States, and that has negative impacts on both soil and air. And then certainly the cake, as I referenced earlier, can be land applied directly. So this is the best option, in my opinion.
So what you're saying is this is the best way to deal with this waste, even if it's a bit of a nuisance for the nearby neighbors for a few days.
It's in my opinion, it's the most environmentally sound method. There is many ways to deal with the material. And in my opinion, it's the most environmentally sound method.
Now, this might be a naive question, but is there any way to go through a process that will help reduce the smell, the odor that comes from this product?
There's, you know, good process control and just managing the material will reduce odors. Incorporating the material will reduce odors, incorporating it into the ground. But that, of course, is really up to the farmers. The farmers can't always incorporate, depending on, you know, what the plants of the field are.
Right. Any fertilizer, whether it's animal waste or whatever they're using, should be incorporated within a short time afterwards. That's regulation, right?
No, that is not correct.
Why?
Because this is a Class A fertilizer.
That makes it different than maybe animal waste from a lagoon or something like that?
Oh, absolutely. And again, just the process that I described that kills off the pathogens and creates a granulated fertilizer-grade material, both EPA and Michigan regulations do not require incorporation of that material. It's really up to the farmer. Incorporation will reduce odors, but it's not required by law.
Manuel Arujo is the Vice President of Operations at NEFCO. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Let's turn now to Mike Person. He's with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality in Adrian Township in Lenawee County. They're using this fertilizer pellet made from sewage sludge from Detroit that's been used on fields. Usually when animal waste is used as a fertilizer, it has to be incorporated, that is, plowed under within a short period of time to avoid odors. The regulations don't require plowing under these pellets. Why not?
So the pellets you're referring to are biosolids pellets, which are basically the residuals that are generated during the treatment of municipal wastewater. In this particular case, these pellets are considered exceptional quality biosolids, meaning they've essentially gone through a significant treatment process that renders these materials so that they're essentially pathogen-free. By doing so, it provides some exemptions to some of the typical regulations, and that one of which being is that they can actually apply these materials and leave them on the surface.
Now, in Lenawee County, like I said, the neighbors of this farm are not happy. They're saying the bad smell has been hanging around for a long time. It's even worse than animal manure. What are the regulations regarding stinking up a neighborhood, or are there any?
Well, we are concerned about potential for, like, nuisance odor conditions related to this program. From what we're hearing, we've had staff people, DEQ biosolid staff people, that have gone out and have investigated the complaints and have confirmed that, in fact, there was odor related to this activity. In talking with the generating facility, they had indicated that this particular batch of was when they were getting initially processed. Although this pellets still met the criteria for exceptional quality, that in the process of trying to create a quote-unquote tweak their process to create a better pellet, that the word we're getting from the generating facility is that it created a pellet that would potentially be a little more odorous than the others. And the good news is our staff people have reported that going out to other sites, because it's not just Adrian area or Lenawee County, these materials are being applied all over Ohio, Canada, as well as Michigan. And from the materials that are being applied this spring, apparently haven't had the same odor issues that they had when they originally started.
So if I understand you, you're saying this was a startup hiccup.
That's what the generating facility believes is the cause for the odors that would be maybe beyond what we would typically expect to see related to EQ biosolids.
Now, you talked about this quality of this biosolid pellet. Basically, you don't have to worry about pathogens as much as you might with raw waste from animals. But what kind of concerns do you have regarding other things such as chemicals or heavy metals that might be present in sewage from a large part of a Detroit metropolitan area ending up on farm fields?
Yeah, there's, you know, many concerns related to the beneficial use of these materials. And it's for the concerns that you mentioned, as well as many, many others, that the federal government, the Environmental Protection Agency, had adopted many years ago, had adopted very stringent requirements regarding that strictly regulated how this program had worked. Subsequent to the federal government, the state of Michigan had adopted our own standards for land application, which as a starting point is at least as restrictive as the federal requirements. So one of the things that we require is the generating facility has to go through a process to document certain pollutants of concern that may exist, and we have limits that are placed on those materials when they're tested. So they have to test them, they have to determine if they meet a certain limit, and as long as they are below those limitations, they can actually land apply these materials, provided a number of other site restrictions are met.
I want to go back to one point that you made, that this is being used all over Michigan and Ohio and Canada. How many tons are we talking about each year?
Every year, there's probably in the neighborhood of between 170 and 180 generating facilities that participate in a biosolids land application program. So it's being done all over the state. On a given year, we probably have around 90,000 dry tons of biosolids that are beneficially reused on the land as a soil amendment or soil conditioner.
And this is going to be increased because of this new operation in Detroit.
We anticipate that it will increase it significantly, yes.
Mike Person is with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality's Water Resources Division. Thanks very much for explaining this to us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Joining us now via Skype is Project Manager and Research Associate Amy Lohman at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Department of Epidemiology. She's the lead author on a study published in the Journal of Environmental Health Perspectives. It looked at the liquid application of sewer sludge as fertilizer and the subsequent reports of health impacts made by rural residents. Amy, I want to point out to listeners that you looked at the application of liquid sewer sludge fertilizer, not the dry pellets currently being made and used in Michigan. But could you describe your study and how it worked?
Well, about 10 years ago, rural residents who learned of Dr. Steve Wing is the principal investigator of the research, and they had learned of his work on other environmental health and environmental justice topics. And so they contacted them with their concerns that the sewage sludge sprayed on fields across the road was making them sick. And we spoke with people who had connected with us, and we began interviewing them. This is a type of research recruitment known as purposive sampling. It means it's done on purpose. It's done to gather rich information from people who are having the experience. It's different from a type of epidemiological research where you're trying to make the results of the research, generalize it to a whole population of people. So what we have, what we can report on is the experience of these people that we spoke with in our study. And they represent three different states. So there is some interest in the fact that over half of the people living in three different states, many of whom did not know each other, are experiencing similar symptoms.
The people who responded also complained about sludge runoff into creeks. What kind of problems can that cause?
Well, we know generally what can be in the sewage sludge. Sewage sludge, after it's settled out from the wastewater treatment plants, it's then treated to reduce pathogens, which are viruses or bacteria that cause disease. So it's treated to reduce that. Everything else is still present. And so you can imagine everything that comes into our waste stream includes possible pollutants from industries, hospitals, schools, businesses.
Sure, it's not just the stuff we flush down the toilet.
It's not, right. So you can have heavy metals, pharmaceuticals, toxic chemicals, persistent organic pollutants. That's all there. That's all present in that sludge. It hasn't been treated in any way through the treatment process. then that goes on to the fields. And if there's runoff, then those contaminants can get in the waterways, causing problems for wildlife or the water life.
Did anybody complain about fish kills or anything like that?
A number of people did who had lived in these rural communities for their entire life did say that they've noticed, like from childhood when they used to go down to the fishing hole and were able to fish for all sorts of things, they've noticed those things disappear. There's no evidence that it's the sludge that's causing it, but there is that concern.
I want to ask you some questions about this generally, that things that weren't included in your study, such as what are the effects on the plants grown in fields treated with sewage sludge? Can this get into our food or into the food animals consume and then concentrate in the meat we eat?
Cattle do graze on fields where sludge is applied. I don't know of any studies that have really tracked to see, you know, are these contaminants in the sludge, in the milk, or in the meat of the animals and that go to the market? But we do know that some cattle whose meat or milk goes to market do graze on the fields where the sludge isn't applied. And an important note is that there are some regulations in place, at least in the state of North Carolina, that cattle are not to graze for 30 days after the application of sewage sludge. And a number of residents that we spoke with said that they observed cattle grazing ahead of that 30-day period.
Well, that sounds 30 days sounds good for biological contaminants, but heavy metals don't disappear in 30 days. They're still around. The Detroit facility I mentioned at the beginning of the interview is making pellets out of sewage sludge. How might that differ from simply spreading the sludge on fields as your study looked at?
There are two different classes of treated sewage sludge, or biosolids as the industry refers to it. They call it Class A and Class B. The Class A sludge is, from what I could gather, is dried pellet sludge. And that is sludge that has a much more stringent process for reducing pathogen levels compared to the Class B sludge, which has less stringent requirements. So it tries to get to virtually no pathogen presence, of at least indicator pathogens, in the sludge. So technically, you know, in some ways, it should be a little bit safer than the application of Class B liquid or dewatered sludge. But this dried sludge has fewer pathogens. As far as I know, I don't know that this drying process does anything to reduce the presence of any of the other contaminants of concern.
Yeah, and if you have a rain, it's just add water. I suppose that there's still a concern. The Detroit Water and Sewerage Department has been incinerating some of the sludge in an area, a neighborhood that's already one of the most polluted spots in the country. If these pellets are used as fuel, presumably burned elsewhere, what are the concerns about burning this stuff?
I can't say that I have expertise to really respond to that one. I don't know enough about how combustion would change the characteristics of the sludge. I could only presume that, you know, those contaminants would be airborne to some extent and could be respirable or breathable.
It sounds like there's a lot of questions yet to be answered. So what's next for your research?
In addition to the in-depth interviews that we conducted with neighbors of sludge fields, we also conducted an environmental assessment. And for this, we collected cedar and pine needles near residents' homes and analyzed those needles for the presence of chemical flame retardant, which is common in sewage sludge because it's used in furniture and, you know, electronics and textiles.
Are you talking about PBDs?
Yes,
okay.
PBDs or chemical flame retardants. They can become trapped in the wax of those needles. And then through analysis, the scientists were able to find that levels of one type of chemical flame retardant was higher within 3/4 of a mile of fields where the sludge was applied. So that's suggesting that pollutants from the sewage sludge are traveling off-site from the fields where they're applied, potentially exposing residents who may live nearby to harmful pollutants. Respondents who reported stronger odors from the liquid-treated sewage sludge also reported more frequently difficulty breathing, wheezing, and skin rash compared to respondents who lived in an area where there's no liquid sludge applied. That's, again, suggesting that stronger odors of sewage sludge may be associated with more physical symptoms for those who live near those sewage sludge sites. Beyond that, we do not currently have plans or funding to do additional research on the topic.
Well, I hope you can persuade some of your Midwest colleagues to look into the same thing around here. We'd probably like to get a handle on this. Amy Lohman is Project Manager, Research Associate at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Department of Epidemiology. She was the lead author of the study, Land Application of Treated Sewage Sludge, Community Health and Environmental Justice. It was published in the journal Environmental Health Perspectives. Thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Tony Brown, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.